88.3 on your dial, www.kbf.org. It's live streaming, and come Monday or Tuesday, we'll have a podcast. Wage World, every week we talk to some of the most interesting people in the world. And this Friday, we're talking to Professor John Kirk, History Department at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, because we're interested in the fact that all the discussion about 50 years past Martin Luther King's speech, many of the civil rights activities, John's written a number of scholarly books that I have greatly enjoyed. Arsenic was one, several on the Little Rock school crisis. So I lured him in here to talk to us about, well, you've studied some of this. What does 50 years really mean for Little Rock and in general? John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. It means lots of things, I think. You know, some people say nothing's changed, and that's not true. Some things have changed. But then a lot of things seem familiar in the way they were 50 years ago. And then there's a whole bunch of things that have stayed the same but changed the way they look as well. So it's a complicated picture, and it's difficult to untangle. But it's important, I think, to weigh up where we are now against where we were then and kind of present a clearer picture of what's happened and the impact and what's gone right and what's gone wrong.
Well, there's always a long list of rights and wrongs. But in part of your work, you've looked at things like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and its work in Arkansas. That was more than 50 years ago, wasn't it?
That's right. SNCC got here in 1962, and it's one of the untold episodes of the civil rights movement, not just in Arkansas, but nationwide too. Really? Of course, this summer, all the attention will be on Freedom Summer in Mississippi. And that was the big project that SNCC had. And there's a big film coming out by Stanley Nelson, who a few years ago did the Freedom Rides movie on Freedom Summer. And it's one of the most vaunted pieces of the civil rights movement. Of course, a number of civil rights films have focused on Mississippi, Mississippi Burning and a bunch of others. Looking at the Meg Graver story and Ghosts of Mississippi and all those things. But while all that was happening over in Mississippi, there was a SNCC project in the Arkansas Delta too. It began in 1962 with the sit-ins in Little Rock and the desegregation of the lunch counters in Little Rock in 1963. But then SNCC moved on to headquarters in Pine Bluff, and then it fanned out to the Arkansas Delta to have headquarters in Helena and Forest City and those places. So they were here until around 1967 when funding ran out and they kind of faded away. But then they were replaced by other organizations like warm poverty organizations and all those kinds of things. So while everything was happening in Mississippi, there were freedom summers happening in Arkansas too. And yet nobody, not even in the profession, knows about it. So the Arsenic Book was an attempt to kind of raise consciousness within the profession and within the community about the fact that SNCC were present and active in Arkansas as well as Mississippi and a number of other areas too.
And they had deep roots. I know one of the first organizers I ever hired working for ACORN here in Little Rock was a young woman named Bobby Cox. She was working at the time for the Arkansas Council of Human Relations. And talking to her over the years, her grandmother was from Gould, and she was from Gould, obviously. And I think I may have already told you this story, but her grandmother's house, she put up all the SNCC volunteers down in Gould when they were working on that project. And, of course, they firebombed her house. And that was sort of one of the seminal experiences of her young life and part of what threw her into my arms as an organizer, at least for a while. But it is a piece of history. And then her grandmother had been very active in the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, as well as, you know, George Stith and the rest of them, that it all sort of set the stage for some of the SNCC works. I love that notion that, you know, there's a bridge from one historical period of progressive work to another, and a lot of people don't even realize any of this happened in Arkansas. But it was a fertile area. I know when I got here in 1970, they were still marching in Marianna, and, you know, Earl, they had a big thing in Earl, Arkansas. And I thought, where am I? What year is this? Is this 1970, or when are we? But I'm sure you've seen that in your research as well.
That's right. And a lot of things have been forgotten in the state. The civil rights history in Arkansas in particular has been underwritten. A lot of other states have rediscovered and re-embraced their civil rights history. But Arkansas really lags behind a lot of other places. And, you know, a lot of the talk about the civil rights movement in Arkansas revolves so heavily around 1957 and the Little Rock school crisis. And, of course, that was a big international event. And it's quite right that we talk about that. But my work really over the last, well, I've been working on this for over 20 years now in various different books and articles and chapters, has been really to fill in the rest of the story, to look back at the civil rights movement going back into the 1940s and how organizing for Around the Vault, for example, voter registration drives, and the development of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, really laid the groundwork in the state and led to 1957. And then looking afterwards too, and what happened in the 1960s, and virtually nothing is known about the civil rights movement in Arkansas in the 1960s,
absolutely,
which is its heyday.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've been working very hard to chart those stories and bring those stories out and bring them to attention because, you know, every national story that we hear about, the Freedom Rides, for example, or Freedom Summer, everything happened in Arkansas as well. The Freedom Rides came to Arkansas. They desegregated the bus terminals here. There was a SNCC project that was happening in Arkansas at the same time as over in Mississippi. So all those things that impacted the nation in the 1960s also happened in Arkansas. And yet, if you look to the history books, you wouldn't be able to tell. It's kind of an amnesia there. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. But I think one of the interesting reasons is that Arkansas was one of the states that lost a lot of its black population. In some ways, the main response to discrimination and racism in Arkansas from the black population was to leave. And between 1940 and 1970, Arkansas lost more of its black population than any other state in the Union, both relatively and in absolute terms. So that memory has kind of gone away with it and been transported to other places. So it's less and less in the state itself. So it's important that we in the state kind of look at that history, and it's still out there, and there are people who have knowledge of that history, and you know, we have to write our own history in Arkansas. If anybody's going to do it, it's going to have to be hers here in the state.
Well, and that's certainly true. I can still remember Richmond, California is a refinery town, the Bay Area right across from San Francisco, sort of up the street from Oakland. And once in an action, I started talking to some of the members before they got going on the street corner, 20 or 30 of them, sort of, you know, where are you from? Half of them were from Arkansas, and the rest were from Louisiana and Texas. So, of course, you know, here I was, you know, the organization started in Little Rock. I was living in New Orleans. I mean, it was like all old home week. Everybody wanted to talk about how they fixed this red beans and rice. I mean, it was funny as it could be. But you also wonder if there was, I'm not saying a concerted effort. I'm not a conspiratorialist, but there's always a silence about civil rights work here. I mean, they had to deal with 57, but I know when I got here in 1970, it was something you really had to work to find out what had been going on. And it wasn't all fixed either. I remember as late as 1978 having an Acorn Action south of Pine Bluff out of our office where there were still black and white colored water fountains. Mm-hmm. And that's 1978. I mean, what can you say, huh, John? I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, but there was a vibrant civil rights effort.
There was. And, you know, Arkansas has a kind of interesting relationship with that. On the one hand, Arkansas has always tried to present itself as a progressive place. You know, there's no reason to look here. We're doing pretty well, you know, and you have the stories of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union and the 1957 school crisis and the schools finally opening. And Arkansas likes to think it has a progressive tradition, which it does in fits and starts, that, you know, nothing really happened here. But that's a good way of masking the things that really did happen here and talking about the kinds of discrimination and racism that went on. And really, you need to scratch beneath that surface. And there's also this Arkansas thing that, you know, Arkansans like to say, thank God for Mississippi, because they always made us not look as bad, right? They were poorer. They were more racist. It's always worse over there. So Arkansas has always kind of deflected people looking at it because they say, oh, look at Mississippi. Look at Alabama. We're not as bad as those folks. We didn't lynch as many black people as they did in Mississippi. We didn't do all those things. But those things did happen here. Maybe not the same kind of magnification. But, you know, Arkansans have kind of deftly encouraged people to look elsewhere rather than looking at Arkansas. And they've encouraged Arkansans to look elsewhere and see the civil rights movement happening as somewhere else than in Arkansas rather than right here in the state. And, of course, it was right here in the state. Exactly those things that were happening in other places were happening here, back into the 1940s and up until the present day. But Arkansans just aren't really conscious of what's been going on in their midst. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of work with that. I came to UALR in 2010, and the year afterwards, the university launched its new Institute on Race and Ethnicity. And we had a big launch event that focused on the Freedom Rides and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Brought a bunch of SNCC folks back from around the world, from Hungary, from Nigeria, from England, from all around the place. And all those folks came back. And it was amazing to watch them talk about these things. We had a whole series of panels, but how they connected with people. Lots of people from Arkansas who still lived here came out and were there, and we were at the Mosaic Templars building, and the place was packed from 9 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock in the evening, with different groups of people coming for different panels and a lot of turnover. But you could really see there's a grassroots enthusiasm and a real willingness and a desire to learn about this history, because it has been so forgotten. And, you know, we showcased the Freedom Rides, and there were many people in the city who were completely oblivious to the fact that Freedom Rides ever came through here. You know, there's so much amnesia about what's gone on in the city, and it's been so erased from the city's past that, you know, we really need to make a concerted effort to bring those stories back out into the light and foreground them. And, you know, one of the things we're doing on a regular basis now is starting at Arkansas Civil Rights Heritage Trail, which is down on Clinton Avenue, West Markham. It starts at the old State House Museum. And each year we have a new set of markers that commemorate different anniversaries and different people in the movement. So we're doing some things at UALR to get the ball rolling, to make this more in the public consciousness.
Well, it'd be good if we did, because there's still, you know, Arkansas is one of those places where I remember when I first started trying to raise money for ACORN, I was talking to a foundation executive in New York, and she had to ask her secretary to come bring her an atlas and show her exactly where the heck is Arkansas. You know, I knew it's somewhere over there, but there was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal just last week, in fact, John, that someone who had originally been the head of the Anti-Poverty Agency in the late mid-60s for 3 years, coming out of nowhere, brand new. He wrote of himself as if he was wet behind the ears. He was from some other state. Hadn't been back since that time. But part of his takeaway in this thing was he was pretty convinced, as bad as it was then for African-Americans and poor people in Little Rock, it was probably exactly the same now. Now, he hadn't been back for, you know, 40-odd years, but by God, nothing had changed. But, I mean, there's so much of this is sort of not fully appreciated. We haven't come to closure, I don't think, for our own experience, which is part of your point. I mean, why isn't, I mean, how many civil rights museums do we have across the South? Atlanta, Memphis, Alabama, several places in Alabama. There's things in Louisiana, but you're right. I'm not sure we have anything like that in Arkansas, do we?
I don't think so. You know, the Mosaic Templars building is probably the closest we have to that in town. But civil rights heritage has been embraced by everyone now because it brings money into the state. And, you know, the old segregationists who are now reformed love it as much as anyone else.
They'll sell tickets to anybody, won't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, the governor of Mississippi is really hot on building a big civil rights museum in Jackson now to kind of get people coming into there. Of course, Little Rock is, you know, at the center. It's one of the crucial places in that civil rights story. The 1957 school crisis is something that's taught in the national narrative of the civil rights movement all the time. We have the Mosaic Templars building. We have, of course, the Little Rock Museum, a visitor center out near Central High. We have those things, but it's not still highly visible, I think. You know, the Central is kind of out in the central area, and, you know, with all the redevelopment that's going on downtown and all those kinds of things, there's nothing really central that would say downtown Arkansas is a civil rights place, and that's what it's known for. And the Civil Rights Heritage Trail is an attempt to start to address that. The idea is to have 10 to 12 markers each year to commemorate, and we're on our fourth year this year, I think. And the hope is to put these markers in that go all the way down from the old State House up to the Clinton Presidential Library and back again. Again, to kind of really physically imprint that memory downtown in a really public and visible space, to make sure that people are aware that Arkansas is a really important, visible part of the history of the civil rights movement.
Exactly. Today on Wage World, we're talking to Professor John Kirk about civil rights history. There's been a lot of discussion. I Have a Dream speech, 50 years, and John's making the point about the Civil Rights Trail. How much traffic does that trail get? Who sort of keeps up with it?
The UALR Institute on Race and Ethnicity is the kind of guardian of that, and you can find more about the trail on its website, and it maintains a website, and it's still something in development. You know, it's been going on for, we've got three sets of markers now, so it will be its fourth year this year, and we're still developing it. And one of the things that's in the progress at the moment that we're working on a grant for is to have a podcast that goes along with it so that you can have headphones and that so
right.
you can have a narration that tells you what these markers are for and what happened in that particular place, and you can move down it. And of course, each year it gets longer and longer because we're putting more markers in. So it's a work in progress. It's by no means a completed work, but it's an important start, I think.
And where are you getting the support for that now? Is that a UALR-funded project or...
Yeah,
UALR
has bankrolled most of it now, but it's looking for partners and it's looking for input, of course, all of the time. We're going to the Arkansas Humanities Council for the podcast grant, which is the next phase. But yeah, we have a new director who started, Michael Twyman, in the summer of this year. And fundraising, I'm sure, is high on his agenda because, of course, all this costs. But yeah, the university has kind of primed this project and got things rolling. But yeah, it costs to do, and that's the thing, right?
Everything costs to do, yeah. And it's worth. We'll get back to how people can support and connect with this, because you know there is. I mean, I was surprised several years ago to see the Southern Tenant Farmers Museum in Tyranza.
That's
which,
right.
And I actually didn't know it existed until H.L. Mitchell's son, who works with us in Ottawa, told me about it. And here I was, you know, in and out of Arkansas every year, all the time, right? I had no idea. Knew Mitch and knew all about that. But and I've been to the museum. It's an outstanding piece of work. I mean, but it's right. If you have to go out of your way to go to Tyranza, it's not on anybody's way to anywhere, I don't think. Maybe from Memphis to Jonesboro you can get there. But we really don't make enough of the very rich progressive history we have in Arkansas. And maybe that's not something corporations are really big into. But I think your point about tourism, I mean, people want to know more about their history. People want to know more about the culture here. And we've had a third of our population as African Americans for, you know, way more than 50 years. So people need to be able to embrace that, I think, and learn from it.
I think so, yeah. And the Southern Tenant Farmers Museum is a great museum. We went at the this summer. We went on a kind of tour of Northeast Arkansas, and close by there now, they're also renovating the Johnny Cash Boyer.
I heard all about it. Yeah, it's the same people, I think, who were involved.
That's right. And there's the Hemingway Pfeiffer House up in Piggott, Arkansas, where Ernest Hemingway wrote some of his early stories, and he was married to a woman from Arkansas, and he used to spend his summers there, too.
Wow, so I didn't know that. See, there's another hidden history.
Right. And that's a great museum as well that they've got together, and they've renovated the house and stuff. So, you know, bit by bit, these things are beginning to emerge. And, you know, if you connect the dots and put these pieces together, then there's a tour to do, and, you know, you can spend a weekend, as we did in the summer, kind of up in Northeast Arkansas, just hitting all these spots. So, you know, the more stuff that's developed, the more these pieces are connected together, the more it's going to bring people into the state, the more it's going to help the state economy. And, you know, it makes economic sense, not just moral and spiritual sense, which is important, but it makes economic sense for the state to make the most of its heritage, too. And it's only really pretty late to that game compared to other places.
Well, absolutely. And history is something that's very important. What are you working on these days? You were telling me something about neighborhoods. I want to make sure we get in our time.
That's right. One of the things we've been working on recently is neighborhoods. At the moment, at the Rep Theater, there's a play called Clyburn Park that's about neighborhoods in Chicago. And we've been doing some talks there at the theater, and we did a talk last week at the Clinton School for Public Service related to the play, showing how the issues about neighborhoods in Chicago relate to what's happened in Little Rock. I think it's a really important part of the story of the way that things have changed and the way that things haven't in Little Rock. And in the 1950s, of course, Brown versus Board of Education began desegregation of schools. In the 1960s, downtown Little Rock began to desegregate. But at the same time, what you see is a whole shift in housing patterns, too. The 1949 Housing Act comes down, and Little Rock begins to redevelop the city through a program what becomes known as slum clearance and urban mm-hmm. renewal. And a lot of the city's neighborhoods, and particularly African-American neighborhoods, are targeted. And a lot of African-American neighborhoods downtown, to the north and out west, were condemned and bulldozed and completely erased. And a lot of those families moved to public housing way out of town, kind of Granite Mountain area and Granite Heights and those places. So public housing was built in the east of the city, in the south of the city. And you see, from the 1950s to today, a really massive shift in population. So you used to have in the 1950s a really small downtown compact city with African Americans and whites living next to one another in so-called salt and pepper neighborhoods, because black and white were mixed together, and close blocks of white and African American areas of residence. But from the 1950s onwards, the city really begins to sprawl. And you know, in 1960, the edge of town was university. That was it.
Oh,
there was
absolutely, yeah.
And now if you look at the sprawl out west, it just seems to go on forever and ever. And of course, those areas are predominantly white. And if you go out to the east and south of Little Rock, you see it's predominantly black. And the racial separation in the city in terms of geographical lines, in terms of where people live, makes in many ways Little Rock a more segregated city today than it was 50 years ago. So people think, you know, segregation was something back then, it happened then, and we've moved on now. But Little Rock is effectively more segregated along terms of geography than it was 50 years ago.
Well, and one of the advantages of, you know, healthy living and long life turns out to be you can sometimes live long enough for somebody to tell you you were right after all. There was a piece a couple of years ago in the Arkansas Times looking at the impact of the Wilbur Mills Expressway, which obviously we fought in 1972, 1973, cats and dogs, sued them, made some, got some concessions, but clearly weren't able to stop the construction. So you see it out there now. But we always said, hey, this is going to divide the city between rich and poor, black and white and whatever. And you know what? I was, you know, I'm reading the Arkansas Times article about it. There it's saying, you know, Acorn may have been right. It did divide the city black, and it did. I mean, to save 6 minutes or whatever it was that you save in terms of prime commuter time from the Wilbur Mills Expressway, all it did was Billy Rector and the gang, it opened up the real estate industry, and we fought the blockbusting as they were trying to beat down the Oak Forest neighborhood and argue that basically from university on, that was, you know, you had to be ready because that was going to all go black. And of course, what happens, you know, that's a self-fulfilling kind of prophecy. But I can still remember the signs that people had, our members had out in their front yard saying, you know, this house not for sale. That got national news. But it was, you know, you fight those fights. You don't necessarily win every fight, but that doesn't mean they aren't right. And with the impact of the neighborhoods, how many people have been to the East End? How many people have, you know, these new housing projects sort of in the South End? I can still remember what they used to look like. And I look at them and say, what exactly is that? You know, but it's a part of what goes on. Understanding the urban core and how that impacts on people and jobs is that's an important project if more people would look at it.
Absolutely, absolutely crucial. And, of course, it links profoundly to the schools as well, because the way that neighborhoods go, the schools go. And it always fascinates me. One of the things I've written about are the origins of school desegregation in Little Rock. You know, the first thing that Little Rock does when it's asked to desegregate schools is build two new segregated schools. So downtown used to be Central High School for whites and Dunbar High School for blacks, and those used to be the two schools that everybody went to. In 1954, after the Brown v. Board of Education comes down, the city builds two new high schools. One is Horace Mann High School out in the east, African-American area. The other is Hall High, out right there in the west at the time. And, you know, you can see how both neighborhoods and schools develop hand in hand to become more and more segregated and more designated by race. So, you know, you can see it happening. And it's funny that you mentioned the I-630 because...
What they call it?
I-630 now, yeah. Wilbur Mills Highway.
It's like people's maiden names, you know. Right, if their name was Jones, it stays Jones. I don't care how many years they're married. I don't. No matter what the number is, that's the Wilbur Mills Expressway to me. I'm sorry.
Right, absolutely.
I'm dating myself, and I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, well, we have a public history, a master's program in the history department, and last year one of our students wrote their thesis on the expressway.
Oh, really?
Okay. And I was just reading her piece last night because she's just written an article on the basis of it that she's trying to get published in the Arkansas Historical Quarterly. And so I was reading all about that and about Acorn's role in it. And she's done a lot of great work on it. But, you know, one of the things about that also, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that the Acorn papers for the organization are in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes, they are, in the Library of Social Change.
Right, and the Arkansas SNCC papers are in Wisconsin.
That's right.
And the prime core of Daisy Bates's papers are in Wisconsin. And a lot of the papers and a lot of the history, the state hasn't really made an effort to hang on to. And the state's papers and all the things that you would use as a historian to write that history have often been shipped out of state because the state hasn't made a big enough effort, particularly with 20th century African-American history, to keep it here. You know, it amazes me that, you know, I've done research for 20 years on this. And of course, there's a lot to be gained here in terms of oral histories and the memories of people. But for a lot of the time, the paper trail, the archival research I've done, has been outside of Arkansas because it's in Washington, D.C., it's in Madison, Wisconsin, and Arkansas hasn't really made a concerted effort to collect its African-American history, particularly its 20th century African-American history. And if it doesn't collect those papers, if it doesn't collect that past, then of course that past isn't going to get written.
Well, and you know, this is a sore subject. We could talk a long time about this. So when I made the decision to move the papers to the Social Change Collection in Madison, you know, it's the Wisconsin Historical Society that does this, I called UALR, I called the library system at that point. This was in the late 1970s, because you could see, I mean, it was pre-digitizing everything. You wouldn't even imagine what digital meant, but they had no interest, but I had to go somewhere with the papers. And so in the early 80s, I made the accession deal with the Social Change Collection. That's where National Welfare Rights' papers were. It's just a core, SNCC. I mean, that's where we belonged, Highlander Center. And they were willing to support it. And, of course, you know, you think you know everything at different times. And I thought, well, you know, here's one advantage. That's supported. It's not a private institution. It's supported by the state legislature. No problem there, of course. Now in Wisconsin, the state legislature would do anything to get rid of that particular collection. So, you know, I maybe wasn't as I was smart for a long time, and then, you know, as stupid as everybody else.
Well, things change, and I certainly don't blame Acorn or Daisy Bates for putting their papers there. As you said, nobody was interested.
But hey, it's still that same way. 2-3 years ago, I had a meeting here with the Central Arkansas Library System. They have a big archival thing to say there were some records that were duplicates or other records I had personally that. You know, maybe we, you know, I felt badly that we didn't have more Acorn records here in Arkansas. And it was just a meeting that went nowhere. I mean,
well, that's a shame.
Well,
that's sad to hear.
You know how these things work. I mean, you can say you're giving it, but unless you have a real commitment, it's boxes that don't get opened for 5-10 years. That doesn't make it available to scholars. I mean,
absolutely.
Even in Wisconsin, I mean, when people go look at our records, you know, they know what's in the box, but it's not like as much, you know, you want more to have been done. But to know it's just going to be, you know, in a storeroom, it may be climate controlled, but it could be 20 years before anybody can see it. Well, what do you do?
Well, I've been there. I've been to Wisconsin. I've touched the papers, and I've been through the core records and the Acorn records and the Arkansas SNCC records.
Good.
I may be the only one, but I've been there, and I've touched them, and they are there.
Thank
and
God.
They still exist. And, you know, and I've made copies of them to repatriate some of the collection, at least to Arkansas.
Well, and we still have them here. I mean, believe it or not, in this building, there's an old vault from some time it used to be a bank. And there's so much that we have in there. And we're actually going to do a mini museum here on this floor down from the studio of old KBF Records in Acorn, just because we're trying to get people to do exactly what you're talking about. I'm talking to John Kirk. As you can tell, we're on our own themes here, but Professor Kirk and I are, who's at UALR, is in the history department, and we're talking about civil rights history and progressive history and an important community, urban history of Little Rock and why it's so important. Tell us more about the Civil Rights Trail. We have a couple minutes. I want more people to go walk that trail. Is there a time when they can do that, John?
It's open all the time. The plaques are located in the pavement, so it's inscribed right in the sidewalk. And it begins at the moment at the Old State House Museum. And there are 10 markers there that relate to former SNCC workers in the state and freedom riders. And, of course, just across from there is where the old Trailway station was, where the freedom riders came in.
Right.
Now it's the Stevens Building, but that's where it used to be, where the Trailways was. Next set of markers, the Little Rock Nine, Daisy Bates, and Christopher Mercer, who's one of the attorneys. They're outside the downtown convention center. The next set of markers are outside Little Rock Chamber of Commerce and commemorate 50th anniversary of downtown desegregation last year. And the next set of markers will be heading closer towards Clinton Avenue down in the main business area next year. We don't know quite yet what the next theme is going to be, but it will be topical and relevant.
Is there a map that people can access on a website, or?
I would go to the Institute on Race and Ethnicity website. There is a dedicated website there that explains who all the people are and the reasons, you know, the kind of historical context. But we're working on maps. We're working on podcasts. It's a work in progress, and we're kind of trying to expand on it and looking for partners to help. And, you know, we're open to anyone who wants to come and participate.
So that's www.
ULR, I just Google Institute on Race and Ethnicity, ULR.
Race and Ethnicity. So ULR, and it'll link you right there. You can get all the information. John said earlier, Professor Kirk, that he's looking for input, and he's always available in the history department at UALR. And it sounds like people are writing some interesting papers to help fill in these gaps, too, from the student.
They are, and it sounds
that's
like
a paper
to,
I want to see, that Wilbur Mills paper, yeah.
We need to get some public history MA students down here looking at your records.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's some secret records, as you know, that downstairs Neil's keeping, I'm keeping, so we're ready for business. We've been lucky enough today to be talking to John Kirk, professor at UALR and an author of some great books. I can't recommend too highly his book, Arsenic, about the history of the SNCC project here in Arkansas. It's a very important, often overlooked history. And, of course, he's written very knowledgeably on the history of the 57 school crisis and a number of other things from the, as you were saying, the 40s, the book from 40s to 1970. I didn't get here until 1970, so it was very interesting for me to read that book as well. So I can't recommend that too highly, and we want to thank John. Next week, we have someone talking to us about the new strategy for dealing with foreclosures in Richmond, California, which is to actually condemn them from the banks, take them over, and refinance it that way. This is Wade's World. Next Friday, 9 to 9:30, this is KABF. The voice of the people, 100,000 watts of power, 88.3. Thank you.